shop.
Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a lecture sponsored by the Institute for Human Sciences. Speaking will be Joseph Cerenzioni, Senior Vice President for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress, a prominent Washington think tank. Mr. Cerenzioni will be discussing his new book, Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons, and how it relates to the situations in Iran and North Korea today. We begin with an introduction by Ambassador Hussein Haqqani, Director of the Center for International Relations at Boston University.
Thank you all for joining us to discuss or at least try and make sense of a topic that I'm sure everyone has given some thought to at some point in their lives, and that is the spread of nuclear weapons, weapons of mass destruction. And we could not have asked for a better speaker. Our speaker today, of course, is a dear friend. I have had the privilege of working with Joseph Cerenzioni in Washington, D.C. He is currently the Vice President for National Security at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C., and he teaches at the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. Joe is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and has served as the Director for Nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, which is where I made his acquaintance and developed friendship with him. And he has served on the professional staff of the Armed Services Committee and the Government Operations Committee in the U.S. House of Representatives. Joseph Cerenzioni is one of the most well-known American weapons experts. He is the author of over 200 articles on defense and the co-author of Deadly Arsenals, Nuclear, Biological, and Chemical Threats, and he also wrote Universal Compliance, A Strategy for Nuclear Security. His forthcoming book is Bomb Scare, which I hope that everyone will buy and read. I didn't just say read. It's always good to talk about the buying as well, having been aware of the need for serious books to be actually bought and read by people. So, Joe, share with us why we should all be scared and what we can do to change the situation so that we don't have to be as scared as your book tells us we should be. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Hussein. Thank you very much. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I spent many years in Boston. I was a graduate of the other Boston College. It's a pleasure to be back, a pleasure to have this opportunity to talk with you about what almost everyone agrees is the most pressing national security threat that we face, the proliferation of nuclear weapons. And I want to talk to you a little bit about how we got here, just a little bit about the history. And then I want to use Iran as a sort of a case study. It's in the news, and it really illustrates a number of the problems that we face. Let me tell you a little bit about how we got here. When you think about nuclear weapons, it may surprise many people to realize that they actually began with the Nazis, that it was Adolf Hitler's perceived attempts to build nuclear weapons that stirred scientists in the late 1930s, led by Albert Einstein, but also involving Leo Szilard and Enrico Fermi and others, to write a letter to Franklin Roosevelt in 1939, urging him to start a nuclear weapons program. These scientists were horrified to realize that their discoveries of the last few years in the 1930s of nuclear fission and the vast amounts of energy that are released by nuclear fission could be used for weapons purposes, and that the Nazis might already be doing this. They turned out to be wrong. It turns out that Adolf Hitler was not serious about a program. He was not pursuing it, but we didn't know that. And as a result of their letter and then the intervention of Winston Churchill's government, the United States did, in 1941, begin the Manhattan Project. And in the matter of 3.5 short years, they did what no one else had ever done before. It wasn't because we had the best scientists, although the scientists led by Robert Oppenheimer were some of the smartest scientists in the world. It really was our industrial capability. In most of the $23 billion spent on the Manhattan Project, $2 billion in then-year dollars, the equivalent of 23 now, almost all of that was spent on industrial capability. The U.S., unique among nations, had the ability to build the resources that were necessary to produce the stuff of a bomb. Brigadier General Lester Groves headed up the Manhattan Project, and he built the equivalent of the U.S. automobile industry to produce the enriched uranium and the plutonium that were the fuel for the first two bombs. The uranium enrichment plant that was built in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, was in the shape of a giant U. Each leg of that U was a half mile long. It housed gas diffusion mechanisms, the first way we learned how to enrich uranium, that had a cascade of these gas diffusion tanks through which uranium gas was separated into the element that was most vital to producing the chain reaction, the isotope U-235. It took thousands of diffusion passes through these tanks to get the kind of uranium that we needed. It took years to develop this. Same with the first reactors built out in Washington at Hanford, now still a nuclear site, to produce the kilograms of plutonium that we used in the first bomb. That industrial might is still one of the major obstacles to building nuclear weapons today. It's one of the reasons that more countries don't have nuclear weapons. This is a large industrial undertaking. It's labor rich. It's investment rich. It requires a fairly high state of technology, and it's one of the obstacles that a country like Iran has to overcome in order to try to duplicate the feat that we achieved over 60 years ago. I'll come back to the science of nuclear weapons just a minute, but even before we dropped the first bomb on Hiroshima, the scientists understood what was about to happen. The group of scientists in Chicago, led by Szilard, one of the men who started the program, James Franck, and others, wrote a letter to the president warning that if we didn't have in place an international mechanism to control the bomb immediately after its use, then we would risk the start of an unlimited arms race. Truman, then president, took this to heart, and in 1946, over 61 years ago, he had conservative financier Bernard Baruch present to the UN, the then new United Nations, the first plan for how to stop the proliferation of these weapons. At the time, there were two nuclear weapons in the world, and we had them. And Bernard Baruch stood up to the podium at the United Nations and proposed that we control by an international authority that he called the International Atomic Energy Authority all the dangerous elements of the nuclear fuel cycle, the ability to mine uranium, process it, and enrich it so that people could share the benefits of nuclear power but control the danger that some of that technology could be used for nuclear weapons. He proposed that once that authority was in place, the U.S. would turn over its nuclear weapons to that authority. They would be held for a short period and then destroyed. And in this way, we would never have to use nuclear weapons again. He talked in that speech about all the elements we now talk about today, how to use nuclear energy without the risk of proliferation of nuclear weapons technology, how to ban nuclear tests, how to achieve nuclear disarmament. The Cold War tensions quickly scuttled that accord. Stalin wanted no part of it. If the U.S. had the bomb, he had to have the bomb. And thus began this proliferation chain. A country acquires nuclear weapons almost exclusively because they fear the consequences of not acquiring them. They acquire them for their own protection. They require them to deter other countries or to equalize the military capabilities of their rivals. We see that play out again and again over the last 60 years. South Asia is a case in point. Once India detonated a peaceful nuclear explosion in 1974, then Prime Minister Ali Bhutto said that we famously, Pakistan would eat grass, starve if necessary, in order to match India's capability, which Pakistan soon did. Today, we're struggling with the consequences of this proliferation. I'm skipping over, of course, vast periods in the arms race of how we went from two nuclear weapons to 60,000 nuclear weapons in the 1980s and down now to 27,000 nuclear weapons, because I want to jump to Iran. I want to talk about Iran, about the case in point, about how this is happening. Iran is trying to acquire a nuclear weapons capability, and it's instructive to look at why they're doing this and how they're trying to do this. There are many points you could use for thinking about when Iran's nuclear program began. You could go back to 1953, when the U.S. and Great Britain overthrew the democratically elected president of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, and brought back to power the Shah of Iran and emboldened the Shah to increase the military might of Iran. It led the Shah in the 1960s to start the first nuclear program in Iran, one that was aided and supported by the United States. We, the United States, sold Iran their first nuclear reactor, a 50-megawatt research reactor still operating at Tehran University. We approved the Shah's plans to build 20 nuclear power reactors that would generate some 23,000 megawatts of nuclear power. And even when the Shah wanted to have his own uranium enrichment facility and his own plutonium reprocessing facility, the U.S. went along with it, even though the CIA was telling us that the Shah also had a secret nuclear weapons research underway. Some of the officials who approved that program in the mid-70s are some of the same officials dealing with the Iranian nuclear challenge today. It was then White House Chief of Staff Dick Cheney, then Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, then Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, Brent Scowcroft, and even a young Paul Wolfowitz, involved then at the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. They approved these plans. It was okay with them that Iran acquired the capability then, because the Shah was our friend. He was our gendarme, as they used to say, in the Persian Gulf. He was our ally. And even then, there was this false distinction between good proliferation and bad proliferation. It was okay that our friends got nuclear weapons. What we wanted to do was prevent our enemies from getting nuclear weapons. This is the situation we now confront with Iran today. Because when the Ayatollah came to power in the Iranian Revolution in 1979, the first thing they did was stop the nuclear program. They saw this as Western technology that would make Iran dependent on the West. The Ayatollah wanted no part of this. But about a year after the revolution, Iraq invades Iran, aided by the United States. Now, Iraq was our ally. We were helping Saddam Hussein in his invasion. We gave him intelligence from our satellites to help him locate the Iranian forces. We sold him arms for the war. We vetoed the resolution at the UN Security Council condemning the Iranian use of chemical weapons against Iran. Most Americans don't remember this. The Iranians do. They say all the time, we were alone. No one came to our aid. No one lifted a finger about weapons of mass destruction then. They remember this. They remember 1953, even if most Americans do not. It helps you to understand the very different way Iran and America look at this conflict at this point. I don't just mean our leaders, I mean our people. Because in Iran, there is nearly universal approval for the government's plan to acquire nuclear technology for energy purposes. And that's the government's official position. Polls show, one was just done a few weeks ago, 90% of the Iranian public support this. You ask the Iranian people, should Iran have nuclear weapons? They say no, overwhelmingly. Overwhelmingly. The interesting thing is you ask the American people, should America have nuclear weapons? And overwhelmingly, the answer is also no. An AP poll done just a year ago asked whether Americans were in favor of the elimination of nuclear weapons by all countries. 60% said yes. when you ask them, should the U.S. and their allies have nuclear weapons, but we prevent everyone else from acquiring nuclear weapons, only 13% approve that. But that's our policy today. That's, in fact, what we're acting out. And it's that discriminatory policy that grates on much of the rest of the world, particularly on Iranians. We have 10,000 nuclear weapons, and we're telling Iran that they can't have any, even while the official story is that they, of course, don't want any. But I recount a little bit of this history just to understand the dynamics that have been in play for a long time and continue to play out today. What's the status of Iran's nuclear efforts at this point? My working hypothesis is that Iran used to have a nuclear weapons program. It does not have an advanced, hidden nuclear weapons activity at this point. That it abandoned the nuclear weapons work that it began once again during the war with Iraq, where it started up its program again, making contact with AQ Khan to buy centrifuges and equipment and knowledge from that Pakistani black marketeer, but has largely completely eliminated that work and instead is embarked on a plan to acquire legally and openly all the technology they would need to build nuclear weapons in the future should they decide to do so. I do not believe the Iranian government has actually made a decision to build a nuclear weapon at this point. I think there are factions in the government with different opinions on this, and that their public position largely is their real position, that we are not pursuing nuclear weapons at this point. In short, they're pursuing the Japan model. Japan has legally acquired the ability to enrich uranium. Japan has legally acquired the means to reprocess plutonium. Those two materials, highly enriched uranium, plutonium, are the stuff of the nuclear bombs. Japan's is in the position where it's not a technological problem to acquire nuclear weapons. It's a political decision not to do so. Iran, I believe, wants to be in that same position, and that might actually work for Iran, to have this virtual nuclear capability. They may acquire all the benefits that they need from just having that capability, the diplomatic, political, strategic advantage it would give Iran in the region. Let's talk a little bit about the technological state of the program, where we stand with Iran. Iran is building a nuclear reactor in Bushehr. This will be the only nuclear power reactor in the Middle East. No other country in the Middle East has a nuclear power reactor. The Shah began this reactor, contracting with West Germany to build it. The clerical regime restarted this program in the 80s. They couldn't get Germany to finish the job. They went to Russia to complete the construction. It's a very lucrative contract for Russia. It's worth about $1 billion. There's a Bushehr 2 that's also planned that will net another $1 billion. And Iran has announced a plan identical to the Shah's to build about 20 nuclear reactors in the country. And we now know that they secretly started a uranium enrichment program disclosed by Iranian dissidents in December 2002 and have started a plutonium reprocessing facility. The problem with nuclear energy is not the reactor. It's what goes into and comes out of the reactor. The reactor depends on nuclear fuel rods that are produced by enriching uranium. The Iranians have all the components they need in country to make those fuel rods if they fulfill their program. They are mining the uranium in their mines in southern Iran. They bring it up, they mill it at the site, getting rid of the rocks and the junk they don't want to produce uranium concentrate that looks like yellow cake powder, hence the name yellow cake. They then take that yellow cake up to Isfahan to the uranium conversion facility. I visited this facility in March 2005. Touring the facility, we were the first Westerners outside inspectors to be allowed into the plant. And as I was putting on the paper hat and baggies and cloak to go into this facility, I suddenly thought, I wonder what the Iranian OSHA regulations are here. How much exposure do they allow in Iran? But it was too late. I was committed. I went to the facility, an impressive facility, an advanced industrial facility. Very few countries had this uranium conversion capability. They combined the yellow cake with fluorine gas to produce uranium hexafluoride, UF6 they call it, a highly toxic substance, highly corrosive substance. But then they take this UF6 in large capsules, large containers, up to Natanz, where they built a uranium centrifuge facility. It's now in its test stages. They started out with it with single centrifuges, then they hooked 20 centrifuges together. Now they have a cascade of 164 centrifuges. These centrifuges look like large water tanks. They're made of special alloys. The metal walls have to be extremely thin but capable of withstanding the pressures and heat that's generated by the rotors inside these centrifuges that whip this uranium hexafluoride around at supersonic speed, sending the heavier element, the isotope U-238 of uranium, to the outer wall and leaving the lighter isotope, U-235, inside the center of that gas whirling around. Why is that important? Because most uranium, when it comes out of the ground, is made up of the most common isotope, U-238. 99% of it is U-238. It's a perfectly nice isotope, nothing wrong with it, except that it doesn't undergo fission very often. But U-235, which makes up 0.7% of natural uranium, does undergo fission every time it is hit with a neutron. This is the one that pops. This is the one that, when it's split in half, releases a large amount of energy and a spray of neutrons that are available for splitting other nearby uranium-235 atoms. And that's the trick. You have to get other uranium-235 atoms to be nearby so they can be hit. So you spin that gas around the centrifuge, and then you siphon out the gas in the center. And when you've done that, you have a slightly enriched ratio, a slightly higher quantity of U-235 atoms in that gas. But it's nowhere near enough, so you have to take that gas and do it again and again and again and again. In fact, you have to do this thousands of times until you get to a 3% enrichment rate, until 3% of the atoms in this mixture are U-235. Then you can stop, 3 to 5%. You can stop, fashion that gas into a dioxide, into a powder, press that powder into pellets, line those pellets up into fuel rods, insert those fuel rods in your reactor, you moderate the reaction, you have a controlled chain reaction that releases heat, that turns the water into steam, that drives the turbines, that gives you electricity. So 20% of the electricity in the United States is now generated by nuclear power. So 2 out of every 10 light bulbs is formed by that reaction. The trouble is the very same facilities can keep going. And instead of stopping at 2 or 3 or 5%, they can go all the way up to 90%. Now 90% of that material is U-235. That's the stuff you need for a bomb, and you don't need that much of it. 25 kilograms or less, if you know what you're doing. A chunk the size of a small melon is all you need for a nuclear bomb. If Iran goes ahead and installs the 3,000 centrifuges they're now talking about, it will take them somewhere between 8 to 12 months to run that gas through to produce enough material, enough highly enriched uranium for one bomb. If they go ahead with the 50,000 centrifuges at Natanz, they'll be able in a year of operation to produce enough low-enriched uranium for one fuel load for the reactor or enough high-enriched uranium for about 12 bombs. That's your problem. Do you trust Iran that this is all for peaceful purposes? Right now, the world community has said, no, we don't. You have got to stop this uranium enrichment program, answer all the outstanding questions we have about your past activity, and only when you restore trust are we willing to let you go. That's the essence of the IAEA complaint about Iran. That's the essence of the UN Security Council sanctions enacted in December. Stop in place. Suspend, talk, answer our questions, build faith. Then maybe you can go ahead with this uranium enrichment program. The other part of the fuel cycle is what happens after you've burned those rods up in the reactor. You take them out of the reactor after 18 months to 3 years, and something very interesting has happened in that process, besides producing a lot of highly toxic radioactive materials. Remember those U-238 isotopes that we didn't care too much about? Well, some of those U-238 atoms absorb a neutron in the process, and they transform into an entirely new element. It undergoes beta decay. One of the neutrons turns to a proton, and instead you go from U-238, uranium-238, to a new element, a brand new element, never before existed, neptunium-239, which has a very short half-life, quickly decays into one of the neutrons, switches over to a proton, and now you have plutonium-239. By the way, you get this? Uranus, Neptune, Pluto, uranium, neptunium, plutonium. Scientists were just following the solar system out there, and it's plutonium that really pops. This is much more fissile than the uranium-235 that you started off with. In fact, it only takes about 4 kilograms of plutonium, about the size of a plum, to detonate a nuclear bomb. We pursued both paths. Hiroshima, uranium. Nagasaki, plutonium. Countries still follow these same paths today. North Korea, plutonium. Pakistan, uranium. Iran is trying to pursue both, like us. Uranium in the lead. That's the danger. The very famed facility that can reprocess these spent fuel rods for waste disposal can reprocess them to get the plutonium for nuclear bombs. This is what we're trying to stop. How do you do this? How do you stop Iran from doing this? How do you stop any country from doing this? There are 5 basic approaches to stopping Iran at this point. The first, which seems to be the current policy, is muddle through. This is typically the default position in American foreign policy, particularly when you have a divided government, which is what we have now, Congress in one hand, administration in the other, and the administration itself deeply divided between ideological hardliners, often called the neoconservatives, and more pragmatist elements, usually headquartered in the State Department. You can't reach a consensus on any step, so you do a little bit of this, you do a little bit of that, you hope for the best. You hope that things work out so that something changes that makes that resolves the problem. Sometimes muddling through actually works. Germany was reunited, not because of anything we did. It just happened. We didn't have a policy for it. It happened. But you can't allow national security to be left in the hands of the fates, especially in this situation where the critical decision points are coming up in the next couple of years. This has to be resolved in the next couple of years, or else Iran will have established facts on the ground that will make it almost impossible to reverse their progress. Or worse, one of the other factions might, with their own solution, might prevail, and we might end up in a military conflict. So I think you have to reject the muddle-through solution. Choice number 2, regime change. Often favored by many in this administration, by peaceful means or coercive means, squeeze Iran, sanctions, restrictions, diplomatic isolation, fund opposition groups, fund insurgent groups. We are funding groups in Iran in the north and in the south that are fighting against the clerical regime. 2 problems with this. This is going to take way too long. The democratic transformation process is a much longer problem, as we're painfully learning in Iraq, than many people suspect. And there's no guarantee that a democratic Iran would have a different position from the clerical regime. They might see the same threats, the same calculation. And in fact, as I said, this is a nationalist program. It's supported by all political factions in Iran, not the creature of the clerical regime. Remember, the Shah began Iran's nuclear program. I think you have to reject that transformation solution. Option number 3, military strikes. I believe this option is actually favored by a significant faction in the administration, mainly led by Vice President Cheney. In fact, Vice President Cheney's national security advisor, John Hanna, was recently quoted in the Washington Post as saying that 2007 is the year of Iran. David Wormser, the Middle East expert for Vice President Cheney, Elliot Abrams, the national security director of Middle East policy, I believe also favor this option. For them, Iraq was supposed to be the beginning, not the end. Iraq was supposed to be the beginning of serial regime change in the Middle East. It was never supposed to stop at Baghdad. It was supposed to include Damascus, Tehran, Riyadh. All those governments were to be transformed, with the accelerator of the U.S. military driving the process. I believe a military strikes against Iran's nuclear facilities, which are feasible, which we could do, would delay the program for a short period of time, but it would have disastrous consequences. If you like the Iraq war, wait till you see the Iran war. Iran has a half dozen or more asymmetrical responses which would be devastating to the United States and our allies in the region. U.S. troops could come under attack in Iraq from Shia militia. Israel is most certainly to be hit and dragged into the battle.
closing down the Straits of Hormuz, which send oil prices skyrocketing past $100 a barrel, more likely $200 a barrel. That would have severe economic repercussions, perhaps a global recession, and we're just getting started. You can imagine what the international Muslim reaction would be to the United States attacking yet another Muslim nation. I think U.S. economic, political, and commercial facilities around the world would be at risk. So I reject that regime change option by force. I forgot to mention, the worst part about this is that it doesn't actually stop the program. It accelerates it. The debate inside Iran would be over. It would be pedal to the metal. They would go get a bomb as quickly as they could by whatever means necessary. You would guarantee a nuclear-armed Iran with that strategy. So I reject that strategy, but I believe there is still a debate in the administration and some people are pushing it. I personally rated about a 40% chance that this administration will decide to take military action against Iran sometime in this year. The fourth possibility is grand bargain. Flint Leverett at the New America Foundation proposes something like this. Others favor it as well, that you have a grand bargain with the United States, the way we're trying to have with North Korea. You put all the issues on the table, terrorism, relationship with Israel, a nuclear program. Those are our concerns. Put together packets of economic incentives, diplomatic assurances, security assurances, and you have a grand bargain with Iran that fundamentally transformed the U.S. and Iranian relationship, and that's the way you solve this. I have a lot of sympathy with this proposal. I like the goal. I think you have to end up at that point somewhere along the line, but I think it's way too ambitious. I don't think either government, either in Washington or in Tehran, are ready to make that kind of bargain. I don't think either one of them can make that kind of bargain at this point. And it holds the nuclear issue hostage to resolution of all the other issues. For me, it's that nuclear security issue that's the driver that has to be resolved even while we have these other issues on the table. So I reject the grand bargain strategy. And like Sherlock Holmes, when you reject all the probabilities, whatever is left, no matter how improbable, must be the truth, I am left with my strategy, which I call contain and engage. It recognizes that we have to put in place instruments that can contain both the Iranian nuclear program and Iran's regional ambitions. We have to keep the sanctions going. We have to keep the unity of the Security Council. We have to keep the diplomatic and political pressure and economic pressure on Iran, which is mounting. We can talk about this more if you like. But these economic sanctions that were adopted by the UN Security Council last year in December were very minor in their particular economic bite, only affecting 10 companies and 12 individuals. But they had a much larger financial impact on Iran. They have crippled financial confidence in Iran. Investors are withholding investment decisions, investment capital, because of the uncertain future. This isn't a political judgment. It's a financial judgment. It's business. And therefore, Iran is now in a financial crisis. They have cash shortages. The Russians recently complained that the Iranians were not paying them for completion of the Bushehr reactor and have started to slow down work that would lead to the opening of that reactor sometime this year. You keep those kinds of sanctions up, you keep that kind of pressure up, you have to back Iran into a corner, you have to convince them that they can't get away with just their current policy, that if they just keep persisting, it won't work, we're not going away, but then you have to open up a door for them. You have to give them some place to go. So you have to abandon the idea that sanctions can coerce a country into compliance or capitulation. That has never happened. That has never happened. No country has ever been coerced into giving up its nuclear weapons or program. But lots of countries have been convinced to. Ukraine, Belarus, Kazakhstan. Argentina and Brazil abandoned nuclear programs in the 1980s. We now know that Iraq, probably the most coercive example, gave up the program in 1991. It was gone. It was finished. It wasn't a mistake. It was a conscious decision Saddam Hussein made. He didn't think he had a secret nuclear program. He knew. He gave it up. It was a choice. Libya is the most recent example, and maybe, just maybe, we can get North Korea to do it. If the North Korea deal works, it will be what Tony Snow says it is. Press spokesman for the White House, Tony Snow, calls it a template for how to deal with Iran. I agree with that. I think that's the only time I'm ever going to say this. Tony Snow is right. Tony Snow is right. That's what you have to do. You have to be able to open that door. You have to be able to engage Iran. And I say we engage Iran on multiple levels. First and most importantly, we should do what Jim Baker says. We should negotiate with our adversaries. Negotiations are not appeasement. It's their statecraft. Of course we should be talking to Iran. Not to Ahmadinejad. He does not run Iran's foreign policy. He is not in charge of the nuclear dossier. We should be talking to the pragmatists inside the Iranian government. We should isolate Ahmadinejad. We should be smarter than we have been in our foreign policy. Recognize that Iran is not a unitary state actor, that is, in fact, it is factionalized into various competing political factions, and that the Ahmadinejad faction, which has been riding high for most of the last 18 months, is now in decline. Newspapers controlled by the Supreme Leader are criticizing Ahmadinejad's policy, particularly after the UN sanctions resolution. This was a stunner to the Iranians. They never thought the United States was going to be able to keep the Security Council together. They thought we'd push too hard, too fast. Instead, pragmatists in control, we compromised. We overruled John Bolton's instincts. We compromised on a policy that looked weak, weak sanctions. You remember the criticism when it came out, but it kept the unity of the Security Council. Russia voted for it, their strongest ally. China went with Russia. And suddenly you had the United Nations condemning Iran. It blew Ahmadinejad's storyline. It wasn't the U.S. against Iran. It was the rest of the world against Iran. The United Nations has tremendous popularity inside Iran. This is Iran's idea of how the world should be run, international agreements. And so to have the U.N. condemn Iran was a blow to Ahmadinejad. It shook up the supreme leader. It shook up that faction, coupled with the investment crisis that's following. You see all kinds of signs that people are interested in making and having a compromise. Now, what they want to compromise on is they want to keep everything they're doing and have a new relationship with the United States. So the trick is to convince them that the price of the new relationship with the United States, the security assurances that will end our regime change options, that will guarantee the security of their regime just the way we guaranteed Muammar Gaddafi's regime, just the way we're proposing to guarantee the security of Kim Jong-il's regime, that the price of that is they have to give up their nuclear weapons option. So that's the coercion part. I think you put those two things together, contain and engage, and you can get a deal. It won't be easy. Iran is to North Korea as North Korea is to Libya. Libya was a relatively easy case, and that took 10 years of discussions over three administrations to get to this point. North Korea is much more complicated than Libya. They actually have nuclear weapons. They actually have operating conditions. But Iran is much more complicated still. Iran has something that the rest of the world wants, unlike North Korea, oil. But I think the underlying forces are all driving towards that direction. What will help seal the deal? You have to understand all the forces that are in play in something like this. It's not just about Iran. In order to get Iran to back off from this, you have to do more than just talk to them. You have to do more than just send over the U.S. wrestling team, which is what we did last month. They reported back. They got standing ovations from the Iranian people. That's another level of engagement. You have to do more than cultural and educational exchanges. You have to do more than something I advocate, which is that U.S. members of Congress should go over to Iran, open up their own channels. If the president won't do it, maybe the leaders of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Carl Levin and John Warner, should do it. Talk to the Iranians. You have to do more than that. You have to deal with the bigger picture as well. You're going to have to deal with this fuel cycle issue. You have to go back to Bernard Baruch. You have to go back to the things we were talking about for 60 years and finally, once and for all, fix the loophole in the nonproliferation regime, solve the fuel cycle problem. And Mohammed El-Baradei, the director general of the IAEA, has a solution. The solution is Bernard Baruch's solution. You establish an international authority to have a fuel bank that can guarantee that every country can get the fuel they need at market rates and that there will be no cutoff of supply. So if you're going to develop what many people are saying is the energy of the future, you won't be held to the whims of a particular supplier or the political influence of the largest power in the world. You will have a guaranteed supply of fuel that can give you the energy security you need. And everyone should be to have to deal from the same bank. You can't have a world where some people are allowed to enrich uranium and some people aren't. You can't have that kind of have add to the dichotomy that exists now where some people are allowed to have nuclear weapons and some people aren't. You can't have that with the fuel either. You've got to resolve the fuel problem. Iran's going to have to see that the solution to its crisis is part of this larger resolution. And here's the tougher part. It also has to be seen as part of a resolution to the Middle East problem of nuclear weapons. That you Iran has to see that if they're giving this up, down the road, there is a path to what has been the U.S. position for over 30 years, a nuclear-free Middle East. This is technically Israel's position as well. And I argue that this is in Israel's interests. Professor Khani and I have talked about this over the years. It's in Israel's interest to give up its nuclear weapons, because it's unstable to have a region with one nuclear power. That cannot last. The choice is not for Israel to keep its weapons and prevent other countries from getting them. The choice is whether it wants to live in a Middle East with one, if it chooses to give up its weapons, or it will live in a Middle East where there's not one nuclear power, Israel, but two, three, four, five nuclear powers. And this is the real risk of Iran's program. It's not that they're going to acquire a bomb and use it against us or Israel. No. Deterrence is alive and well. They understand what would happen next. We have purely conventional power, so does Israel, that can destroy Iran should it be foolish enough to do that. It's not even that they're going to give it to terrorists, although that is a risk, but no country ever has done so, and it's really not in Iran's interest to take something they've worked so hard to get and give it to a group they can't control, and would be blamed for its use in any event, whether it was true or not. Why is that in Iran's interest? No, the danger is what happens in the region. What does Saudi Arabia do? What does Egypt do? What does Turkey do? I'll tell you what they're doing now. They've suddenly declared, after 60 years of very little interest, they've suddenly declared that they want to have a nuclear power program too. President Mubarak's son has announced that Egypt is starting a nuclear power program. Turkey has said the same thing. Saudi Arabia and the other states of the Gulf Cooperative Council have said the same thing. Tunisia, Morocco. Understand this. There is only one nuclear power reactor in the Middle East. It's in Bushehr. There's only two in all of Africa. It's in South Africa. After 60 years, suddenly 10 Arab countries decide they need nuclear power. This is not about nuclear power. This is nuclear hedging. This is how proliferation begets proliferation. This is how proliferation spreads. It's not what does the United States do. It's what does your neighbor do. That's the history of proliferation, and we know how to stop it. You have to stop it from starting. You can't allow Iran to get that nuclear weapons option. That's why this is so important. Because if they do, they will set off a nuclear reaction chain that will ripple out of the region and go around the world and lead to the collapse of the nuclear nonproliferation regime. That's why the stakes are so high. That's why we've got to get this strategy right. We're at this nuclear tipping point. We have to hope for some people. We have to pray that our leaders are wise enough to make the right choices. Thank you very much. Let me stop there.
In your book, you talk about 50 countries having between them about enough fissile material for what, 800,000 or 300,000? 300,000 bombs. And you say that 30 of them at least have like 1 metric ton of fissile material. So isn't the genie already out of the bottle as far as proliferation is concerned? And how can that be brought back under your containment, the bigger picture of containment, as opposed to just the Iran-related part of the containment strategy?
Stopping the proliferation of nuclear weapons has never been primarily a technical problem. It's a political problem. The technology exists on a global scale for making these weapons. There are some 40 countries that could make these weapons if they wanted to. As Professor Akhani says, there's about 50 countries that have quantities of highly enriched uranium that could be used for these bombs. Countries have made the political decision not to go ahead with this, but it wasn't always true. In the 50s and 60s, many countries were exploring nuclear weapons programs. It looked like we were going to have a world where there were many nuclear nations. In fact, it was Senator Kennedy in his third presidential debate with then-Vice President Nixon who warned in 1960 that unless we changed our policy, in fact, unless we took this threat seriously, we would go from the four nuclear weapon states that then existed, the U.S., Russia, Great Britain, and France, to a world where there would be 15, 20, or 25 nuclear nations. He wasn't worried about rogue states then, although Red China was at the top of his list, and Red China did, in 1964, detonate a nuclear bomb. He was worried about our allies. West Germany was talking about it. Japan was talking about it. Sweden had a program to produce nuclear weapons. Australia had it under discussion. Switzerland was talking about it. In other words, it was the thing to do. The great powers were acquiring these nuclear weapons. If you wanted to be a great power or at least maintain leverage with these great powers, you had to acquire nuclear weapons also. It wasn't just about protection, the number one driver, security, the number one driver for nuclear weapons. It was also about prestige. Why some countries, India is a classic example, France could be a classic example too, why some countries choose to acquire these weapons. And it was also about domestic politics. Those three together, protection, prestige, and politics are the three main drivers that have always existed. Domestic politics, this issue plays well in domestic politics. Witness how Ahmadinejad is using this issue. You had to do something to counter those drivers. Fortunately, Kennedy did. He started the negotiations for nuclear nonproliferation treaty. He couldn't finish the job. Johnson did. Johnson couldn't sign it. Nixon did. And that began this era of liberal, conservative, Republican, Democratic cooperation that produced this interlocking network of treaties and agreements that are the nonproliferation regime. It didn't work perfectly, but it turned the tide. Now the norm became that we were not going to acquire nuclear weapons. And those countries with nuclear weapons were going to give them up. And it was well recognized at the time that there was an intimate connection between the great powers' stockpile of nuclear weapons and other countries' decisions to acquire them. Not perfect, but an influence, a factor in other countries' decisions, and most importantly, where countries saw the world going. Were we heading to a world with more nuclear weapon states, in which case they bet they wanted to be part of that race? Or were we heading to a world with fewer nuclear weapons, in which case you could get prestige and protection by not having nuclear weapons?
I was wondering if you could comment on missile defense systems and President Putin's recent speech condemning the United States policy.
I spent a good part of my professional life investigating ballistic missile defenses, and I can tell you that none of them worked. We have invested since the President Reagan's March 23rd, 1983 speech, we have invested over $150 billion in trying to develop systems that would shoot down long-range ballistic missiles. None of them worked. Not the X-ray laser, not the ground-based laser, not the free electron laser, not brilliant pebbles, not space-based lasers. There was even a proposal for an atomic catapult. This was a crazy proposal that would set off and use an atomic bomb to launch an interceptor into space. None of this stuff worked. Ted Postol at MIT is probably one of the premier physicists who analyzed this. And the main problems that ballistic missile defense has encountered from the 60s are still the problems that prevent it from working today. It is much easier to overwhelm the system than it is to proliferate defenses. It is much easier to spoof the system with countermeasures or decoys than it is to develop the technologies that can reliably acquire the signature of the warhead, the reentry vehicle that you need. If we know exactly the characteristics of the warhead, where it is going, where it has come from, it turns out we can hit a bullet with a bullet. This is an amazing technological achievement. We can do it, but it requires certain knowledge of the threat, knowledge that a real-life enemy is very unlikely to supply us with. And this is why all the tests of the missile defense systems up until this point have been frauds. They are testing for success. They are making the test as easy as possible. And even with that, the track record is spotty. But none of the tests have taken place in realistic conditions, with decoys, countermeasures, the kinds of things that this National Intelligence Estimate on the ballistic missile threat indicates, that even a rudimentary ballistic missile state such as North Korea would be able to deploy. If you can build an ICBM, you can build at least six different kinds of countermeasures to accompany your warhead. Fortunately, the ballistic missile threat is shrinking, not increasing. There were fewer ballistic missiles in the world that can hit the United States now than there were 15 years ago. There were fewer countries trying to build long-range ballistic missiles. The ones that are still engaged in it are less technologically advanced and poorer than the countries we faced 15 years ago. The threat is, by almost any measure, significantly lower now than it was then. So the idea that we're spending $10 billion a year on ballistic missile defense indicates that this is an ideologically driven program, not a threat-driven program. It's not based on our technology. It's based on the misguided notions of political figures and ideologues who have promoted this program over and above the wisdom of the Joint Chiefs and most scientists that work on this. I believe we're going to watch the decline of this ballistic missile program over the next few years. As the defense budget collapses, which it will, we cannot afford to spend $700 billion on national defense, which is what the bill is this year, the core budget plus Iraq, not yet, Iraq and Afghanistan. As that budget shrinks, the Joint Chiefs will step in, as they have in the past, to rein in the wasteful spending on programs that don't work and that they don't back. And that includes that frozen turkey of a device that we're building up in Alaska. I believe we're going to shut that one down, just as Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld shut down the first failed attempt in the mid-1970s in Grand Forks. That cost us $22 billion, never worked. We finally shut it down. This one up in Alaska is going to probably ring in at something like $60 billion. It'll never work. I think we'll shut it down. With that answer, I think we've reached the end of our time. I'd like to thank you all for giving me the opportunity to talk to you, and thank you very much for staying through this long and somewhat depressing lecture. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture sponsored by the Institute for Human Sciences, featuring Joseph Cerencioni, Senior Vice President for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress, a prominent Washington think tank. Mr. Cerencioni was discussing his new book, Bomb Scare: The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons, and how it relates to the situations in Iran and North Korea today. We began with an introduction by Ambassador Hussein Haqqani, Director of the Center for International Relations at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog, with help from Michelle Tash. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.